Rooted in faith. Rooted in family. Rooted in values. Rooted in traditions. Welcome to the Rooted Outdoors Podcast. And now your hosts, Corey Bauman and Dave Ashworth.
Welcome to the Rooted Outdoors Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Corey Bauman. I'm here with Dave Ashworth, and we have an exciting guest that we've been following for years now. And we reached out, and here he is. He's here. So we're going to introduce him in a second. Many of you probably recognize him. But Dave, you have any updates? I know you were at the farm this week. So what happened at the farm, man?
Yeah, I had an awesome weekend. So we every year we do a youth hunt. We get a young boy or girl out to take them hunting. Sometimes, a lot of times, it's their first hunt, and we film the whole thing. We put together a film, and when we did that this year, we made a little bit of a mistake when we were out there. So we filmed interviews in a barn, and the barn roof is tin. And so for anybody out there, if you want to film an interview in a barn, make sure it's not raining, because that is really, really loud. And I was trying to monitor it with my headphones, and I was going back and forth. I was like, can we hear it? Can we not? I'm like, it'll be fine. Go back and listen to it. And it just sounds like a bunch of fuzz, and you can't hear it. And you can hear the words, but it just sounds terrible. So I brought them back out. We did a little coyote hunting at the farm, and we refilmed the interviews, got some other B-roll stuff. So we are super pumped about our film that's going to be coming out, probably not for a while, but probably not till, you know, end of the year. But I'm pretty confident it's going to be the best work that we've ever put out. So really excited for that.
Yep. And I would say the only update I have, as we were talking about yesterday, is we have footage of this deer that it was the first deer that Dave and I were together in the stand that we filmed. Together that I shot on public land in Pennsylvania. So have not put it together. I've started that thing like six times, and I just can't figure out how to put it all together. And we've learned so much over the last probably 5 years. And so I finally have a clear vision of what that's going to look like. So we're going to hopefully finish that up and have that out sometime right before the season starts. So that's our two things that we're working on now. But dude, if you don't have anything else, let's just jump right in.
Let's do it. I'm ready.
All right. So next to me, I think he's next to me. Looks like he's next to me. It could be below me. I mean, who knows? When you record this thing, sometimes it's whatever. But so with us tonight, we have Aaron Warbritton, and he is with he's with the Hunting Public. So he originally is from Paris, Missouri. He said it's a small town. Let him tell you about that. He currently lives in South Iowa, and you guys are probably familiar with the Hunting Public. They have a huge YouTube following, YouTube station or YouTube channel. They do the deer tour, they do turkey tour, and I personally just love following their stuff because it's so relatable. And I can't wait to jump in with you. So, Aaron, I know that your parent company is the Woods Guys Inc. that owns Hunting Public, but Aaron, man, we're happy to have you. And just anxious to chat with you about all this Hunting Public stuff.
Thanks, dudes.
Yeah,
man. I'm excited.
Sure. Yeah, and if you haven't heard of the Hunting Public, I'm not sure where you've been living for the past couple of years, because like those guys just are doing incredible stuff, and every video they put out is must watch. They know what they're doing, super educational. So if you haven't heard of them, you need to pause this and go to YouTube and check out their stuff, because it is awesome.
Yeah. I think Dave and I talk about this all the time, because we haven't been filming that long, but you know, we do film our hunts and stuff. What we love about you guys is the style of your hunts and how you, like, I don't want to use the term raw, but like a lot of it is just raw footage. And I know you're editing your stuff and things like that, but you know, for a long time, we were like, hey, let's make this cool cinematic film. And we still have a little bit of that. But I think when we started to watch your stuff, we're like, man, like there is a really cool way to film it where it's documentary style. It's in the heat of the action, that kind of thing. So we just really appreciate what you guys are doing. And I know that you have a huge following. So
thanks. Appreciate that.
So how did you guys get into, how did you guys get into filming? Tell us your story a little bit.
Well, we all come from different areas, but I would say somewhat similar backgrounds. The interesting thing about our group is that we all have like very different personalities, each one of us in the entire group.
Yep.
But we all come from similar backgrounds in hunting. So what mine anyway, I started very, very young. I mean, as I was hunting, well, not hunting, but I was going to the woods on hunting trips, track jobs and things of that nature with my dad, my uncles, my cousins when I was 5, 6 years old. I mean, I was out there in the woods doing something. And then I just eventually, my whole family has hunted, you know, since long before I was born. So it just came very natural. And like you mentioned earlier, I'm from Paris, Missouri. It's a very small town in Northeast Missouri. It's a rural community. And that's what you do. A lot of people grow up hunting, farming around there. And I was no different. I grew up hunting and learned a ton from my uncles and my dad, my cousins. And we hunted mainly on public land and on permission. And when I had just started hunting when I was 11, 12 years old and really getting into bow hunting at that age, we had lots of places to hunt. Mm-hmm. And even going up into the, you know, my high school years, I had lots and lots of places to hunt, lots of friends around town that also hunted. But, you know, I was buddies with 4 or 5 different kids in school that all hunted, and we all hunted the same areas. Some of them were my spots, some of them were their spots. You know, and then all hunted public land together. So it was really great growing up in that type of environment. And then as I got older and started getting into college, you started to really see that access drying up. You know, a lot of the farmers weren't allowing you to knock on doors and go hunt anymore. They were wanting you to pay money for leasing because demand was going up, obviously, at that time.
Yeah.
And I'm 32 now. I mean, I'm talking 15 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
And it just became harder and harder and harder to get a place to hunt. And it was really sad. You know, there were places where I shot my first buck with a bow, a farm that my uncle hunted back in the early 70s.
Wow.
And my cousins killed their first deer there. I killed my first buck with a bow there. I have all these great memories there on that farm and eventually lost it. And it was a sad day watching them take tree stands out of that place. Yeah. You know, and I don't blame the people for leasing it at all. It's a great deer hunting property. But that's just the nature of what happened to us. And as I got older, I realized this is happening to people all over the place.
Yep.
And it was a problem 10 years ago. And now that problem has helped create a very serious issue in hunting. And that is, we don't have the hunter replacement numbers that we used to. We're not, I mean, we're still recruiting hunters, but we're not retaining them at a level that we used to be at all. So I guess the grand scheme of things here, that's why we started the Hunting Public,
yeah,
was just to show people that you can have great experiences hunting with your buddies on any type of property. I mean, it's not necessarily just hunting public land, although that is what we do most of the time. We want to show people you can go out there and have fun on any property, yep, with your friends, family, whoever. And you can shoot whatever the heck you want.
Yep. They're there. You're just going to find them, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
I think that's awesome, too, because a lot of people make the excuse of, well, I don't have any private land, or mm-hmm, I don't have any of these managed farms, so I can't have success. And obviously you guys have shown that not to be true. You know, that no matter who you are, everybody has access to public land. Anybody can go out and hunt public land. And you guys have done just an awesome job showing that you can have success doing that. If you know, obviously you guys work hard and you put in the time and the effort to scout and to look at maps and do your homework. But there really is no excuse. If someone wants to get into hunting and they want to have some success, the options to do that are out there.
Yep. Oh yeah, certainly, especially in whitetail hunting. You don't, a whitetail deer does not need very much you know, uninhabited land in order to survive and for you to be able to hunt there effectively. It's not like an elk, you know. And that's why we still have a lot of room to grow in whitetail hunting and turkey hunting for that matter.
For sure.
To that point, you know, though, and you guys know, it's like the whitetail is the most adaptive big game that's out there. Like, you think about, we were just talking before we got on here, like how much suburban, like good suburban hunting there is, you know what I mean? Where there's small pockets of like areas around Philadelphia and stuff like that, where Atlanta, like, and with the guys from like Seek One have, you know, they created a whole show around suburban hunting, you know, like the deer, they adapt to like wherever they are pushed to from development and things like that, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So a question for you was, I know you touched on it briefly, but obviously you guys do mainly public hunting, if not all public land hunting. Was your push for that really to get other people, to show other people that, hey, this can be done, to recruit hunters? Was it out of necessity because you just really weren't getting permission anymore? Or was it more of, you know, typically public land is a little tougher just because there's a lot more competition there? Was it more of a, you know, just challenging yourself, or was it a kind of a combination of all three of those things?
I would say it was a combination of all those things. We all hunted public land in some way, shape, or form, you know, growing up and even through college and stuff. And when the majority of us met at Midwest Whitetail years ago, and that's in Southern Iowa where we all met. And when we got there, it was very difficult to find land to hunt on. Very hard. We would get permission occasionally on some properties, but you were mainly, if you wanted to have multiple experiences out there on different pieces of land, you were going to have to lease land or buy land. And, you know, we didn't have the kind of money to do that. So we just went back. It was really like not a big deal. We were just like, well, let's just go hunt public up the road.
Yeah.
You know, and why not? Because that's what we'd hunted it before in other states. Like, why not try it here? And it was great. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, I moved to Texas back in end of 2017 for work, and man, it's so different out here. Like, I mean, everything is a lease. But you know, growing up hunting public land, it's funny. Like, you know, you meet people out here and stuff, and they look at you like you're crazy. Because they're like, oh, there's no public land in Texas. And while there's not, like, percentage-wise, there's not. But there is, and there's still deer on public land. And, like, while I saw, like, literally probably saw two deer last year because it was the first year I really scouted. You know, I found deer. Like, they're there. You got to know how to hunt them. And because everything's such a lease, too, like, there's no – I'm not saying there's none, but – very rarely can you get permission to hunt anything because the leases are, I mean, they're expensive too here. And you know, and again, we can get into the whole thing about baiting and all that stuff. Like, I just didn't grow up hunting on a feeder and I just won't do it. Like, it's just not my thing. I'd much rather pursue an animal on public land and not see anything or see one or two or whatever than go sit in front of a feeder. Like, it's just not going to be me ever. So it's just different. It's different learning, but it's been fun. I mean, I had a blast last year trying to learn different terrain and stuff and, you know, all kinds of different things, Bob.
Yeah. So this next question, I'm sure this will segue into more questions, additional conversation, but what do you think has attributed to the most to the success that you guys have on public land? You know, a lot of people hunt public land, but aren't able to have the success that you guys have. It seems like you guys are, you know, always being able to, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of times where you don't, but it does seem like you guys, you know, are able to harvest animals when you go out. What do you think has attributed to that? Maybe it's one main thing, maybe it's a couple things. And then, you know, based on that answer, maybe dive into some of those a little bit deeper.
We keep a very open mind when we go into these hunts. And to Corey's point a minute ago, basically when you start hunting and scouting all these different areas of public land, you put yourself in so many different situations. And that's really what whitetail hunting is it's very situational, almost to the day. I mean, you can hunt the same exact spot 10 days in a row, and it's going to be slightly different situation every single day, whether it's like wind speed, weather, you know, all these different factors of food sources change. So by hunting all of these different public areas, it really hones your skills as a woodsman, because you're more readily focused on varying situations. But I would say a big part of it is just keeping an open mind. Like, and it's very basic. We overcomplicate things as hunters, and I'm terrible at it because I overthink everything. But, and it's cost me a lot of opportunities over the years.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm just almost too analytical about some things. But it's so basic. It's like, once you get out there, once you learn to read sign and understand where the deer bed, then you just have to put yourself within bow range of the spot that he's going to walk. Now, that sounds easy when I say it like that. It's not, it's obviously not that easy, but we tend to overcomplicate things. For example, I hear all the time, like, I watch these three bucks walk 80 yards away from my tree stand, and I just couldn't get them to come over. Well, why are you sitting in that tree stand? Get out and move 60 yards closer and shoot one of those things. You know, yeah. I mean, that's seriously all you got to do. And a lot of times people will get hemmed into these, you know, these tactics or techniques. And I don't know where they got them from, if it was hunting media over the years or what, but they're like, oh, I got to hunt out of a tree stand, or I got to hunt this field edge because I see more deer here. What are your goals when you go out there? Are you going out there to harvest a deer? Are you going out there to watch deer? You know, if you ultimately want to harvest one, then wherever that deer feels most comfortable moving in daylight is where you got to set up.
Right.
And that's pretty much the bottom line. Like, you got to find a way to set up in that spot, regardless of if it's outside your comfort zone or not. You have to get to that spot and then find a way to set up.
Yep.
And another reason, if you will, if why we're successful, quote unquote, is because we shoot whatever makes us happy. We don't go into hunts, you know, necessarily with outlandish goals in mind. We're not the group of hunters that's going to say, well, I'm going to eat my tag for the next 6 years until I shoot a booner. No,
yeah.
That ain't going to work. Not with us anyway.
Yeah.
So we go into all these hunts with very realistic expectations. If we're going into a state and we got 5-6 days, the first legitimate high odds ethical opportunity that we get, we're probably going to take, you know, and we'll be thrilled with the results.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that helps too.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, I think having that mindset is huge of, you know, whatever gets you excited. I think people get too caught up on it's got to score this, or it's got to be this old. And I know, you know, I'm sure, you know, just like us, you guys are looking for more mature, older deer. But if it gets you excited, like, I mean, that's really all that matters. Everything else just shouldn't matter. And we get so caught up on that with comparing things. I know I've done it, like comparing to other people, and, oh, well, he shot this, I got to shoot this, or he can do it, I can do it. And it's like, you know, you don't know anybody else's story and what they're doing. And so having that mindset of just, like you said, simplifying that of, if it makes me excited, I'm going to shoot it, is a great mindset to have.
Yeah. We're not playing a baseball game.
Yeah.
we're killing deer.
Yeah,
and that's it's your tag. It's completely up to you.
Yeah.
You know, and I used to pass up bucks every year with that mindset. And I, at the end of one season, I'd passed up numerous bucks, and every one of them come right into the spot that I wanted to kill them. And my heart was pounding, and I was measuring G3s or yeah. beams, or yeah. he's not heavy enough, or he's too thin through the back. He's a 2 or 3 year old. What reality of it was, is like, I didn't know any of that stuff.
Right.
And at the end of the day, I ended up taking a bad shot on a bigger, older deer at a further distance, and I wounded him and lost him. And I just, that really pissed me off when I did that. I was like, what are you doing out here?
Yeah.
You know, are you out here to try to compete with everybody else and sling arrows and wound bucks? Or are you out here to fill your tag and be happy with the results.
Yeah.
And if I would have shot one of those younger bucks, I'd have been thrilled.
Right.
Yep. You know,
what do you think led to kind of that mind shift? Cause I know for me, like that's not as much recently, but in the past, that's been a big struggle of mine was, you know, just waiting and waiting and not wanting to shoot deer and then comparing to others. And that was causing me not to shoot deer. And, you know, what do you think kind of changed for you that made you switch, and has it ultimately made you more, you know, successful hunting?
Well, that season I was just telling you about was when I was about 21 years old, 22. And at that point I'd harvested several nice bucks with my bow and I was being super picky. And I had a regular job working at an appliance store, you know, during the day and going to college. I didn't have a ton of time available. So when I did get my vacation, I was hunting daylight to dark nonstop. And I was putting a lot of stress and concern on shooting a big, big buck. And when I didn't do it, I was ticked off. And I'm like, I remember after I wounded that buck, I was walking back to the house after looking for him for a long time, made a terrible shot. And I was thinking like, what the hell are you doing? Like what? You had so much fun when you were growing up, when you were 10, 11, 12 years old. And I always like to, my personality anyway, is I'm always trying to put myself in other people's shoes. I want to see what their perspective is on a subject or a topic or issue, as well as my own. That way I can better understand, you know, how it works between people. And I was thinking to myself, like, what would the 12-year-old you be doing right now? Like, if you just put yourself in that mindset when you were growing up deer hunting and how, I mean, I almost never had a trip to the woods that was not freaking awesome when I was that little.
Yeah.
And by the time I got older, I was putting so much pressure on myself to shoot a certain size deer because of the factors that you mentioned. I was like, this is stupid. This is not what got me into this in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing is those deer were still getting me just as excited as they did when I was 12, 13 years old. Mm-hmm. I was just making a different decision based on all these outside factors that I couldn't control.
Yeah.
I'm like, forget that. So at that point, I kept hunting mature bucks. And I'm still extremely interested in hunting mature bucks. We're all everywhere we go. That's what our goal is.
Yeah.
Make no mistake. But if we set up for particular situation and a younger buck walks into that hole at 15 yards, we're gonna let him have it and be just stoked about it because the plan worked. You know, you set up in a spot to shoot a deer there and one walked in there and you shot it and you killed it. The plan worked. And yeah, you learn a ton just by doing that. My mindset changed. There was no more pessimism in hunting. It was all optimistic and everything was like, every time you go in, you're thinking like, okay, it's going to happen today, you know, and you're way sharper, make fewer bad shots that way. Because you're just way more confident in your abilities. I think that's why I messed up on that big buck I was telling you about before, is because I'd second guessed myself through that entire season on which deer I was going to shoot. And I finally got the one that I wanted to shoot in front of me. And I put so much pressure on myself during that situation that I failed.
Yep. I think one of the things too, as you're talking, it makes me think of like our property that I was telling you about that we have hunted for like 4 years now. And you know, when you're hunting public land, like I guess you can use trail cameras, and I certainly have. You know, I had public land in Pennsylvania that was 10 minutes from my house. So I'd go in, I'd go to a spot, I'd lock it up and hope it would stay there, right? But like, I'm sure you guys are out there, you're on the deer tour, stuff like that. Like maybe use them. I don't know. You can answer that question, but you know, you have a parcel that's yours and you own it. You've got trail cameras out. In fact, before we even jumped on this, Dave and I were talking about where our trail cameras are going to be and where our cell cams are going to be on this property. It causes you to get into a mindset of what you're just talking about, right? Like I'll give you an example. So we have this deer. We actually don't know if he's still alive, but we've been chasing him for, this would be probably a third year we've hunted him. He's an older deer. He was a giant. We actually think he got injured and just had a funky like left side. And it was a crazy, it's a crazy deer. He's an old deer. He's big. And you get like obsessed, like watching these deer, and you know, Dave, it's Dave's real property, right? So I'll film them or whatever, and if Dave gets a chance to shoot them, great. But I mean, we spent a whole year, like, literally we're not shooting another deer. Like, we're gonna wait till this deer comes out. And that's the mentality you get in, right? Because you're using trail cameras, and I'm not opposed to them. I think they're great and they work. But there's also a time where, like, it's good not to have a trail camera, like, and get in that mindset where you're on public land, and whatever comes in that makes you happy, you shoot it.
It also helps keep you more open-minded to the situation.
Yeah.
You know, if you get locked in on a particular animal, you'll start to do repetitive things. You'll start to pattern yourself around where you've seen that deer, what that deer has done, you know, before, because you're not worried about any of the other ones.
Yeah.
And that can be detrimental to your success as well, because the deer then begin to pattern you, mm-hmm. you know? But I got nothing against hunting a specific deer. I was hunting one last fall on public in Iowa a little bit. I hunted him a handful of times, but I also still really enjoy going and learning new areas. That's the thing that we love doing the most. That place that I was hunting that big deer on, I had hunted for several years and I knew it really well. And it was one of those situations where to kill this deer, I was going to have to invest the whole season in hunting the same areas that I'd already hunted in the past. You know, you'd essentially already kind of figured out the lay of the land. You're just waiting for an opportunity.
Yep.
So you're almost waiting for luck to happen to you. You know, and I don't like hunting that way. I want to be able to go into a spot and believe that he is right there and he's going to walk out on this trail and I'm going to shoot him in this spot the size of a car hood right here in front of me at my, you know, 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Instead of just, you know, rolling the dice and waiting for the luck to happen to you. And I'm not saying that's how it is when you're hunting individual deer. It's not. Every situation is different, but.
Yep. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I got to ask you because, I guess my first question would be is, I know that you guys don't, and it's a joke. I know it's a joke. You guys don't use, you know, scent sprays and stuff like that.
No.
Was there a time though, when you did believe in like cover scent and all that kind of stuff, and like, just how did you get to the point you're at now? Was that just really becoming more of a woodsman and understanding how the wind works more and things like that, thermals, all that good stuff? How did you get to the spot now where it's just whatever goes?
Dude, I used to be so paranoid about that stuff. And like, yeah. I mentioned a while ago to Dave about the perspective thing. That's one thing I'm always trying to do, is try to understand like why somebody does what they do and has success using it, you know, and then maybe I can take a little piece of that experience and throw it into my own style or whatever, because that's part of the fun, right? It's kind of figuring out what works best for you. But I used to have bags with cedar limbs in them and dirt and leaves, and I did everything. I mean, when I was growing up, we used to swear by like that scent killer spray.
Yep.
I sprayed it down with it nonstop. I mean, I would go through gallons of it in a season.
Yep.
And then it was like the carbon clothing and all that. I mean, I did it all. And to my knowledge, I use just about everything on the market that has to do with scent control. And several of the other guys in our group have also, and we have abandoned all of it, mm-hmm. just because it almost comes down to like efficiency. Your mind can only think of the average person's mind, I should say, my mind, I should say.
My mind too.
We're in there.
You can only process so many things, right? In a given day, there's only so many things you can do. So if you have such a stringent scent control regimen, now if you're a genius and you can manage that and all the woodsmanship stuff that you got to be thinking about when you're out there, kudos to you. But we're not that way. It's like, it got to the point where I was focusing so much on all of that scent stuff that I was making mistakes in my setups. I was making mistakes in woodsmanship. I was not spending the amount of time needed to learn the woods and learn wind and how bucks behave. I was spending all my time on gadgetry and figuring out the best method to stay scent free and seeing like mixed results. Never hearing anybody tell me that it 100% worked 100% of the time. And I used it all. And once I started looking at it like objectively towards the end of using that scent control regimen, I started looking at it like, okay, this deer's going downwind. Is it actually smelling me right now? And about half the time it seemed like they were. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try this completely opposite. I'm going to wear stinky clothes out here and regular shoes and all this and see what happens. And literally the same thing happened. Mm. Still got winded. They still smelled something some of the time. Sometimes they walked right through my wind and didn't care one bit. Mm. It was, and that was with all these different scent control products. So like, it wasn't necessarily something that was a light switch decision. It was a process of 5-10 years worth of changing it up, you know, in a fairly large sample size of hunters that we communicate and talk with. Like, yeah, we're real good friends with the guys at the Hunting Beast, Dan and Fault.
Yeah.
A lot of those beast tactic style guys. And I've learned a ton from them over the years. And we had sort of suspected all that leading into meeting them. But once we met those guys and we started talking to them about woodsmanship more, it was like, man, it just isn't worth our time anymore.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I don't think we'll ever go back, because once we started focusing more on woodsmanship and wind, we started having way more success. It's mm-hmm. just naturally.
Do you feel like mainly hunting public land and kind of bouncing around to different spots, it would be different, and maybe it wouldn't be. It'd be different if you were hunting like a lot of private land where you're kind of going back to the same spots over and over again, or it really just doesn't matter.
Pressure is pressure is what we've learned. And we do hunt some private land. I hunt my family farm in Northeast Missouri. It's about 100 acres still. And then we do lots of consulting work on private properties. That's actually where we do the majority of our consulting work, is on private properties. And the private land pieces are always the easiest ones to figure out, because you know exactly where the human pressure is. All you got to do is put the map in front of the guys or the people that are hunting the ground, and then say, okay, tell me where you go and how you access every single area and where your trail cameras are. And literally you just X out all that country, and then you circle a spot on the map and say, well, right there's where he's living, because that's where you never go. And you walk in there, and I'm telling you, like 8-9 times out of 10, that's where he is. Hmm. And it
interesting.
Deer don't know whether it's public or private. They just know where there's human scent.
Right.
And everybody's trying to get rid of the human scent. But from what I can tell, this is just my opinion. Yes. Now, there'd be a lot of people disagree with me. You know, unless you're just so extremely anal and you're the only one going in there, I just don't know that you're going to remove everything that you do. Yeah. Maybe you can. But.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think you can. I guess my question, maybe I didn't phrase it exactly right, was like, you know, if I'm going into a private spot and that's my main spot, maybe I'm hunting that 10, 15, 20 times a year. It's bigger, so there's, you know, spots I can bop around. But, you know, if I was hunting public land and let's say it was, you know, unlimited amount of acreage, I could go into this spot, and if I left my scent behind, I just go to the next spot that I had. It wouldn't matter as much. Would you put more emphasis on it if you were hunting that, or really it just doesn't matter because, you know, there's still going to be scent left behind and it doesn't make a difference?
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether we're hunting public or private. We're usually only hunting a spot once.
Okay.
We never go back to the same spot, rarely anyway. And that's not to say you can't harvest a mature buck doing that. You certainly can. It just depends on how much time that you have, though. Because most folks have weekends, or they have a 5-day vacation here and there, or they can get out of work 1 or 2 evenings a week. Most guys don't have 60 sits to go and sit on a private property all fall and wait for luck to fall into their lap. Mm-hmm. you got to go out there and make it happen.
Yeah.
And like to your comparison of public to private, what we do on smaller private parcels is we just don't hunt them as much.
Yeah.
We back off the amount that we hunt. And then whenever we do hunt, we go in super aggressive for the kill. We'll do more. And this goes, this is kind of the same. This is why the public land tactics overlap so much with the private land stuff. We're using cameras. We're using scouting, especially like observation sits and such from a distance, keeping our scent out of the bedding areas. And then we're watching for a buck coming out of one of those bedding areas, either through scouting, like I said, boots on the ground, cameras, or observation sits.
Yep.
Then once we know he's in a particular area, we are not waiting at all. We're going right in there. And we're getting as close as we possibly can to where he's living. And I think that's a mistake that a lot of people make, is that they sort of inch in there, not knowing exactly where he's at. Or they have an opportunity in, say, mid-October, and they don't go after him then because they think, well, he's going to become more daylight active towards the end of the month or whatever.
Yeah.
And from what I used to think that way, and from what we've learned in the last 6 years or so, I do not anymore. I don't think there's such thing as a nocturnal deer, a fully nocturnal deer, right. That is. So I do see that mistake made often on like smaller private parcels, is that people are very predictable with how and when they check their cameras or they hunt their stands. They hunt a lot of set stands, and they don't put enough pressure on the bucks that they're trying to kill at the correct time.
Yep. Makes sense.
Those are the main mistakes that we've seen made over the years anyway.
One thing that I actually did in Texas last year that I actually think I learned probably from you guys, was I have this, it's a public spot. It's archery only. So I like that about it. And really, I literally haven't seen another guy on it. So I like it. It's probably, oh, I don't know. It's probably, I don't know, 400 acres. So it's not small. It's a pretty decent sized parcel. Anyway, one day I was like, dude, I'm going to push back in as deep as I can get until I bump a deer. Like until I see a deer, I get blown out. Like I'm just going to find the deer. For like the first like couple weeks, I was so tentative. Like I'd hunt the outside. Like I pushed in, bumped a deer at like 10 a.m. I never saw it. It was probably a doe. I don't know. I have no idea. And I was like, heck, I'm just going to hunt right here. Hung, I had a, you know, we use muddy just like you guys do. So I hung my muddy and sat there. Waited a couple hours. I rattled a little bit. I ended up rattling a buck in that day, 2 hours after I bumped that other deer. So to your point, like a lot of guys wouldn't think to do that, I don't think. You know what I mean? They don't want to get aggressive.
They're worried about spooking them.
Yeah.
And we, I mean, that's a legitimate concern. But yeah, sure. From what we've seen, if you're hunting a mature buck especially, and he's living in a particular area, you don't need to be cautious with him. Because he's been living his whole life there, or he wouldn't be a mature buck living in that area. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Like if he's 5-6 years old and he's living constantly in one section of your property, he is so comfortable by that point with that area because you've never went in there,
mm-hmm.
that you're going to catch him by surprise. And if you do go in there and bump him out, oftentimes he's coming right back.
Hmm.
He's not making a huge move. Whitetails, if they don't smell you and they just see you or hear you, oftentimes they're going to run off 400 or 500 yards, stop, turn around, try to figure out what the heck went on, and then try to go back in there and figure out what you were by either going downwind of you, of where you bumped them, or going in there and smelling your boot tracks or whatever. They're coming back in there to find out what was going on because you caught them by surprise. More times than not. And usually that's what happens, because once we get into those sensitive areas, we're sneaky, you know, we're going in really, really quiet. So if we do bump a deer, it's one of those situations that we're right on top of them and they take off like a bat out of hell out of there, but they may not know what the heck you were.
Right.
They may have heard you break a twig. They may have saw you. If they smell you, that's a little different deal. But still, even in our experience, it is not like they run off to the next county. Whitetails just don't have that type of range, especially mature bucks.
Yeah.
They've lived their whole life in that area, and that's where they're comfortable. You know, if they run to the next property where they don't spend a ton of time, they're putting themselves in danger
because
they're not familiar with their environment there. I mean, they could, you know,
could run into anything at that point. You know, they don't want to leave what they've known, you know, because then the unknown could be game over for them, and they know it.
Yep, that's right. So we've seen that happen over and over and over again. Mature bucks go right back in.
Yeah.
To that spot that you spooked them out of.
It's interesting. Yeah, one of the things that I think is so fascinating about, you know, you guys just in general is a lot of these aggressive tactics that you use. I know one of them, I forget, it might have been you, I don't remember, but like taking a turkey call in the woods when you're deer hunting.
That was Ted.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. So like if you bump a deer, you can call a little bit. So then if they didn't smell you, they just think it was a turkey, which makes sense. Pretty interesting. One of my favorite things, and I know Ted, I guess it was last year, and I'm sure, you know, a bunch of you guys have done it, is getting on the ground.
Yeah.
And I've like never thought, that's never even crossed my mind. Cause it's just like, if I get like, I barely have an advantage up in this tree. If I get down on the ground, like I have no advantage. Like I can't see as far, like I have nothing. And like you guys do stuff like that all the time. And I know you mentioned before just the openness to kind of just do whatever. So, you know, I don't even know what question to ask, but I'd love for you to just kind of talk about your mindset with that. And, you know, if there's other things that you have, you know, put in place that have been super aggressive that have worked out. Cause I think like, a lot of times we give the deer too much credit saying like, oh, if I get down on the ground, I'll never kill him. Or if I do this, I'll never kill him. Like I have to be in a tree and I have to be doing this and I have to be doing this. And it's end of the day, they're an animal and you can do other things. So I'd love to hear you kind of just touch on that a little bit.
Well, I mean, I'll briefly touch on the scent thing one more time. Mm-hmm. And that, because that leads into our decision to do these kind of off the wall aggressive things. We don't care anymore about them smelling us. We just assume when we go into an area that it is burned. Like when we set foot in there, we'll go in there and scout a property, blow the bedding out in April or June, July, August, or February. We'll blow it out completely and scout it all completely. But then we won't come back in there until it's time to hunt. Like we will not set foot in there. It's like your get out of jail free card that they give you, you know, that you catch them by surprise. They're blown out. They come right back in. They settle back down. It's that constant pressure that especially mature bucks get onto. It's that constant pressure. So with that said, we're going in and we're not worried about leaving our scent in a given area because we're just trying to get to the spot that day where we think he is going to be so we can kill him. And when you throw all that other stuff out of the window, it makes it way easier to go in there. And what ends up happening more times than not is we kill them at the spot that we anticipate we're going to shoot them. So you go into the edge of a bedding area and you're creeping in there super quiet. You're looking for tree stand options, but you're also looking for ground options. You're looking for any weakness that he's going to give you within his setup where you can get in there and get an arrow in him. And oftentimes it's one trail with a fresh rub leading out of a bedding area and a set of big tracks coming in and going out that are fresh on that one trail. And if you just plop down right there within 20 yards of that thing, get the wind in your favor, it's going to make for a boring ass hunt. Because you're going to sit there on one trail where you can't, like you said, if you're on the ground, you can't see anything. Right. You got to be super quiet because they can slide up on you. But if you're focused on that trail and that movement coming out of the bedding, you're ready to go. Mm-hmm. You just got to, and it, Ted said it last fall, he's like, man, that's hard to do, but once it works, your confidence goes way up for future hunts. Once you've actually physically been there and seen it work, then you have the confidence to set up in those spots, in those situations. But yeah, more times than not, we're not setting up to cover five trails or, you know, whatever. It's set up to shoot one scrape in one spot, or it's set up to shoot this trail and this movement coming from this direction. Yep. You know, and majority of the time, that's where we're killing them. Obviously, not every time we go out there. You know, all the time, nothing shows up.
Right.
You know, or something may come in where you don't expect it and booger you or whatever. But sure, more times than not, it's just getting to that spot that the deer wants to be and making do with whatever setup you have. That's why we like the saddles too, is because it's one more option.
Yeah.
You know, a tree stand may be the best play in that particular situation. A tree saddle may be the best play. A ground setup may be the best play.
Yep.
Still hunting at times could be the best thing through a bedding area. If you got wet and windy conditions and you've got a short period of time to get it done, still hunting right through that thing in the middle of the rut, you could shoot one easily doing that. Yeah. So there's a number. I mean, we do wind bumping as well, where we'll send, it's not a full blown deer drive, where we'll just have two guys. One guy will be on the downwind side of the bedding area on the exit trails, and the other one will go on the upwind side, letting his scent drift through the bedding area. And then those bucks will ease out, or the deer period, they'll ease back out on those trails, not running Mach 3, you know, because they're not getting pushed by a dozen drivers. They're leaving because they smelled the other guy.
Yeah.
And you're set up to kill them on their escape. We do that all the time on public too. You know, we hunt escape routes on bedding areas when there's like waterfowl or bird hunting pressure or whatever it is.
Yep.
That's the biggest key though, is just being open-minded.
Makes sense. One, curious to hear your thoughts on this and kind of how you approach this. So if, you know, you're in a tree, you see a deer, maybe it's a deer that's a nice deer, but it's maybe just out of range. You see it kind of walk away and walk off. Will you ever consider like getting down, trying to go around and cut them off at a different spot? Or are you just kind of, you know, just kind of, so you have you done that before and had success doing that? Or you just have given it a shot a couple times?
Yeah, no, we have. And that's actually what Ted did last year before he shot his buck on the ground in Missouri. They watched a nice buck go through an opening, and they immediately jetted out of the stand, and they tried to get down and around that deer, got around him, set up for like 30 minutes, didn't see him, and then backed off and went back to those trails, which those bucks were walking on. And then 2 hours later, Ted shot that buck coming down the same trail that he'd already seen that movement on.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like this, you know, it was a strategy that changed 4 different times throughout the course of the day.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Ended up working out.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it's cool to like, I don't know, I can't tell you how many times I've sat in a stand and, you know, seen a nice buck come by a little out of range and see him kind of go off. And I have the thought in my head like, man, I bet I could go and cut him off here. I know exactly where he's going. And you just don't do it because it's like, that's nuts. Like, who the heck does that? Like, I'm hunting. I need to be in a tree stand. And then watching you guys do that type of stuff and have success doing it, you know, makes you think like, you know what, like maybe I will give this a shot next time that happens. It's, I don't know. It's just a total mind.
I did it by total accident the first time that it worked. I was 16 and I was actually rifle hunting in Missouri, and it was opening day of rifle season, and I was working at the grocery store at the time, stocking shelves. I had to be at work at 8 o'clock. It's like 7:30 and I already know like I'm going to be late for work, and I'm starting to pack up my gear to get down, and I turned around behind the stand, and a nice buck is coming down the middle of the ditch, and he's going by trotting like he either got spooked from the neighbors or he's chasing a doe or something. I got the binos on him, saw it was a good one, and he ran on down the ditch, and I couldn't get a shot. I'm like, well, I can either sit here for the next 10 minutes before I have to go to work, or I can fly out of this thing and try to get over there. And I don't think I would have made this move if I didn't have to get to work. Right. I would have probably sat there because I was still in that conservative mindset back in them days. But I was like, man, I got to get to work. So I got to go and try to kill this thing right now. So I jetted down out of the stand and I ran full blown, just sprinting for like 400 yards around the rim of the ridge and got around the backside and got to this tree, and I'm huffing and puffing and I'm like, he's got to be over here somewhere. And all of a sudden I hear crash and I look up ahead of me and he's fighting with another buck at 30 yards. Wow. And he finishes fighting with his deer like 20 seconds later and runs this buck by me, and I shoot him at 6 yards with a 30-30 on the ground.
Wow.
It's awesome.
It was the most insane thing ever. And I was late to work, but it was sweet. It was incredible.
That changed a couple of things for you, which is awesome.
Yeah.
I think it's just something that we don't think about. I remember when it was like a couple of rifle seasons ago, had a buck, and you know, I saw him walk by, and then you kind of play games, or at least I have played games in my head, like, oh, well, maybe he'll come back, or if I get down, then he's gonna walk by my stand and I'm gonna blow it. And it's, you can't really think like that because you have no idea what he's gonna do, and your best chance is probably, you know, going after him than just letting luck and him maybe turning around and coming back to you.
It depends on how much time that you have too.
Sure.
I'm not saying that can't work. I should put that in there as a disclaimer too. There's probably some people that may listen to your podcast that are like, well, I sit the same stand every year and I shoot bucks out of it every year, and you know, I'll set it for 10 days. I mean, I get it. I've seen it work. Like this is no way the gospel only truth that you believe is what's coming out of my mouth. I'm just sharing my different perspectives that we've had. There's more than one way to skin the cat, certainly.
Right.
I mean, it's a fact that an all day sit during the rut, like that stuff works for sure, but it's also more fun.
Oh yeah.
Moving around, right.
Certainly.
And you're doing aggressive stuff.
Yeah.
Like that. I mean, it's boring sitting in the stands.
Yeah. We kill them on all day sits and stuff too. The main thing to take away from our tactics is that we are most of the time super aggressive, and it's always situational. Now, whether or not we get the situation right is beside the point, but we always are going into a hunt with a specific situation in mind, and we may adapt to it in some way, you know, throughout the hunt, like Ted did with that one that you were mentioning a minute ago.
Yep.
It's just being able to adapt to those changing situations all the time. You have something slightly different on every single hunt that you got to account for.
Makes sense.
You might've answered this, in a way, but so like you guys go into a new spot, new public land spot. You haven't scouted it. You're going in the first time. There's good sign. You see some deer, whatever. Like, would you normally hunt it that day then? Because you, like you said, you already kind of, you put your scent down. You probably have the best chance being in there that day. Or would you kind of come up with a game plan and come back the next day? Or would you hunt it that day?
If it was a spot that we found hot sign and we wanted to hunt that exact spot, we would hunt it that day. Oftentimes, we'll scout the outskirts of a bedding area and we'll find hot sign, and then we'll come back to hunt it a day or two later, but we will not hunt that spot that we scouted. We'll hunt further in. Mm-hmm. So if we're coming up to a ridge system, for example, and we start cutting some big rubs or big tracks or scrapes or whatever, sign of some sort, coming out of some predicted bedding areas, we're going to stop there if we can't hunt that day. And then come back and push in deeper to those bedding areas. Or if we can hunt that day, we're going to be looking for a setup at that particular time. We're never going to scout a spot and then come back and hunt that exact same spot at a later date, because we're leaving scent at that point. Thanks. You know, and that's another thing, like when we're going in and we're scouting our way in, if we hit some hot sign along the edge of a bedding area, we're thinking about hunting it, and we've got to make that decision right then and there whether or not we're going to hunt it. Because what we don't like to do is say, well, we'll leave this one for now and maybe come back to it later. You know, in our minds, it don't work that way. You walk past that, you're burning it.
Yep.
You know, you're leaving your scent in there, you're going past, you're walking over the trails that you're going to potentially shoot. You're burning it, you're chalking it up, you're going to the next one. Not to say that 2-3 weeks later things could change and a big buck could be in that same bedding area. They certainly can, you know, but we're always trying to keep track of our ground scent and our pressure like that.
Yeah. Actually, I have another thing I just thought of. So you guys use water access a lot. Do you use water access? I know it varies, but do you use it mainly to access areas that you know there isn't hardly any pressure? Is it you're using water access because that's the only way to get there? Or like what, I guess, what's your primary reason for using the water?
All the above. Okay. And this may or may not be correct depending on your specific situation, but what we see often in the areas that we hunt is that mature bucks live close to water. They bed and they live pretty close to water most of the time. And it only makes sense, you know, if deer have to have food, water, cover, right? And when you find those bedding areas where they have all three in the bedding area, then those become perennially good spots, especially if there's an absence, there has to be an absence of pressure, or like people can't be in there. Otherwise it's no good because the scent's in there. But we see bucks bed on pond dams all the time. We see them bed on the edges of creeks all the time, up in the cove of a lake all the time, not necessarily on the point of a ridge going out into a lake, because that doesn't give them as many escape options as a point of a cove would, for instance. But they tend to want to put themselves, they want to put that water inside of their safe zone if they can, which is sort of the area that they feel comfortable standing up and moving around in during the day. You'll notice when you get to finding these buck bedding areas and you scout them, oftentimes you're going to find a bunch of browse, natural vegetation. There'll be water very close. I've seen mature 6-7-year-old bucks stand up at 3:30 in the afternoon and go get a drink, you know, in the edge of their bedding area. And this might be a buck that you haven't got daylight pictures of for 3 years. You know, it's just because you're not in the area that he's comfortable being in during the day.
Got you.
So to answer your question, sorry to get long-winded there on water, but all of the above, it's all access, and mature bucks seem to favor it.
Yeah.
Probably for one of those reasons too, you know, because it's blocking people from getting in there.
For sure. Makes sense. Cool. We're about an hour here. So maybe we can start wrapping up. Corey, I don't know if you had any other topics. I did want to talk about one thing with you guys, with you. One thing that I appreciate that you guys do really well is just the way you follow all of the rules and regs, like, to the T. I know you had a video where I think it was a buck that was over a property line by, I mean, you could see it, right? It wasn't very far, and you went through, you know, a lot of guys would have just walked over and grabbed it and pulled it over, and that would have been that, and probably no one would have ever known. You did the right thing, and you got permission, and it seems to be a recurring theme with you guys, just really, really following things and doing the right thing. So I guess maybe my question is, why is that so important for you guys to do? And why do you, portray those things and put an emphasis on those things in your videos and your work?
I think because we realize there's a lot, and especially young folks that are getting in, and they look at us as mentors or not. But that's the type of example that we're trying to set for them. I mean, I was heavily influenced by hunting media growing up all the time, you know, and I would only imagine that there's other kids out there that are the same way, watching all kinds of stuff as they get into hunting. We're just trying to paint the right picture for them.
Yeah.
You know, and spread the right message, I suppose. That's where it comes from.
One of the things, now that Dave said that, one of the things, one of the episodes that I really, really had a high respect for you guys, the way you kind of filmed it and put it together was the, I don't remember who it was. I don't remember. It might have been Zach. Maybe shot a buck, and he thought he hit it well, and which happens obviously. And you guys tracked it, and the deer ended up still being alive, and it was after hours. And so the law is you can't put an arrow in the deer. Like, you can't do anything. You basically have to wait till it expires. And I know that, I think you've even mentioned you guys probably got a lot of flack for that on both sides, right? So people believe, oh, you should, that doesn't matter. It's unethical to not, you know, kill the deer, whatever. I think you guys did the right thing. And I think the way you filmed it, you could have very easily just kind of cut the camera, kind of went back and said, hey, this is what happened. But the fact that you kind of, not that you filmed the deer, right? But you filmed kind of the emotion that you guys were going through in that moment. I really kind of respect that, because, you know, it put anybody who was watching that, it put them in your shoes. Whether they believed in the way you handled it or the way you didn't. I just thought that was really cool that you guys did that. And I don't know if you want to touch on that at all or not, but I just wanted to mention it. If anybody out there hasn't seen that episode, it's a really, really good episode. It's a learning lesson. That stuff actually happens. And that's what I love about it. There's too much stuff out there right now where guys are still, you know, they're filming the kill of the deer, like the glory moment, like all that stuff. And they don't see anything else that happens. And it's hunting, man. It's a blood sport. Like, stuff like that happens. So I don't know if you want to touch on that at all or not, but
yeah, that was actually Jake's hunt from Iowa last October. And we've been in similar situations to that as a group in the last 6-7 years, even back when we worked at Midwest Whitetail. But yeah, like you said, we show people what actually happens. I mean, we don't lie to them. We just show them. And that was kind of that's in our mission from the gate, was like, well, we're just going to show people what happens out here and what our decisions are and let the chips fall where they may, with also keeping in mind that we're trying to set a good example for people moving forward, especially new folks, especially new young hunters. That's the biggest deal. And to be honest, in that situation, the deer was liver hit. The boys tracked up on it in the middle of the night, and they saw it alive out ahead of them. They saw its head up. You know, obviously it's dying. Otherwise it would have took off. And I've seen this multiple times. I've had this happen through the course of my life while tracking deer, is walk up on a deer that has not expired yet. And personally, I think the right thing to do then is to dispatch the animal. The right moral thing to do is to do that. But as you said, it's against the law to do so. So we're faced with that decision in that moment. Like, I wasn't there on the track job, but the guys are like calling me and filling me in on things and stuff. And we're all trying to make the right decision as a group. We obviously are going to follow the law. We're filming all this stuff. I mean, it's all documented. We're going to show the public what is happening, and we're not going to show them, you know, we're not in violation on film and just show. But at the same time, we feel like that the right thing to do in that situation, if we legally could, would be to dispatch the deer. And that's why it was so emotional for those guys, is because they felt like, you know, obviously as a hunter, you never want that to happen. And hopefully they at some point will, that gives the hunters the power to do that, the ability to do that.
Was there any moment
without penalizing them in any way?
Was there any time where any of you guys like were thinking maybe to, like, I'm not saying you should or shouldn't have done this, just something I thought of, like calling like a game warden and saying, hey, like, I've got this deer and, you know, is it okay? Or like, I don't know.
I think the boys tried to. Yeah. And couldn't raise anybody, you know, until later on. And it's just one of those deals, you know, the deer's hitting the liver. He's got a few hours to live.
Yeah.
And all you want to do is just put him out of his misery. Yeah. And trying to find the best way to do that at that moment. And when you can't reach him, the warden, then you're just legally just stuck there.
It's tough.
It's a bad deal.
Yeah.
It's tough.
That is tough.
But it happens. I mean, that happens to people all the time. That's why we showed it is, look, we don't try to pretend to be perfect or make the right decision all the time or anything like that, because ain't nobody perfect. Ain't nobody going to be. Yeah. But all we're going to do is show you our honest experiences in the field and what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, you know, what Corey and I appreciated about that one was just the raw emotion, because we've all been there. We've all been in that struggle with yeah. something and what that's like to go through. That's tough. Like, it's just really, really tough to do that. But just thought you guys handled it very well. And I'm sure a lot of people didn't like that. I'm sure they wanted you to just, you know, go against the law, but you know, you guys did the right thing and the law's in place and we need to follow it. Even if we disagree with it, it's still there. We need to follow it. And that can be tough and it can be emotional, especially when it comes to taking an animal's life. Like, that's no joke. And there's a lot of things that can go on when you're involved in a sport like that.
Yeah, it was a tough one for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I have no doubt you guys would, like, I'm sure two people go, well, like, the cameras were on. I'm sure if the cameras were off, it would have been different, you know, whatever. Like, but I mean, I have no doubt you guys would have done the same thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, if the camera's off and it's just you and the deer, then you want to keep a secret or whatever, then that's between you and the deer and
yep.
whatever religion that you yep. believe in, yeah. you know. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing with us is the camera's always on. They're yep. always watching. So we feel like we got to make the right, just do the right thing no matter what happens, yep. you know, and that's part of the deal. And that costs us opportunities. You hear guys say all the time, like, you know, I would have shot right over that fence to shoot that buck or whatever. There's no property line. That's not posted, or maybe yeah. just shoot on that side. It's like, no, guys, you can't.
No.
I'm not going to have a 12-year-old kid watch this show and think that that's okay to do.
No, because, you know, you do one. Okay. Yeah. You know, maybe shooting that deer was not the worst thing, or maybe shooting, you know, a couple yards over that property line is not the worst, but then what does it lead to? Right. Then it's like, oh, well then I'll break this one and then I'll do this and this. And then all of a sudden you're just doing whatever you want. And
yeah,
you gotta follow.
If it's, you're right. And if it's just you out there doing it in the deer, then that's just you personally that, you know, you're affecting with that decision.
Yeah.
But if we're doing it and we're filming that,
right,
like, it's going to affect a lot more people than just us. So we feel responsible yeah. to show that stuff in the right way.
Yeah. Well, it's great. That's great that you guys put that positive light and show how hunting is supposed to be. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, we look up to you guys, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, because you are shedding the right light on hunting and what it's supposed to look like, which is awesome. So
let's start to wrap this thing up.
Yeah.
Where are you guys heading for the deer tour this year? Do you have your states picked out?
Okay. Yeah, we're going to start out going to North Dakota, Nebraska, then Missouri or Wisconsin. Then the Public Land Challenge in Michigan, early October, Iowa, Oklahoma, Kansas,
ooh,
potentially New York during the rut at some point. And then we have gun seasons in early December, run through Christmas, and then we'll be going to Arizona, I think, and nice. We'll hunt a jeez. State down nice.
So
south.
You're, so you're not really traveling at all, it sounds like.
Staying close to home.
Yeah.
No.
It's crazy.
We'll be,
it's cool though.
All awesome. Over the dead gum awesome. Place.
So will you be gone that whole time?
No. Oh. We have a big enough group that, you know, three or four guys will go here, three or four people will go here, you know, two guys will go here for a week. We'll all be splitting up and grabbing, you know, whoever yeah. and going on these trips. But no, not any one person will be gone that entire time.
Okay.
Gotcha. Okay.
Nice. Well, that's sweet, man. I know we can't wait to check it out and watch it and follow along with you guys. And And it's awesome, like we said before, what you guys are doing. We're excited to see what's next. But before we wrap here, tell us, you know, the best places that people can reach you or follow you and all that good stuff.
Just follow us at The Hunting Public on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter. We also have videos on Amazon, and we have a podcast on all the major audio platforms at The Hunting Public.
Awesome, man.
Perfect.
Really appreciate you coming on tonight, man. It was good to get to know you, and things are going to get crazy here real soon.
Yeah, man. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Thanks again, man. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, guys. Y'all have a good one.
Thanks, Aaron. Take care, man.
You too.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel to stay up to date with everything happening at Rooted Outdoors.